Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This incident between a U.S. Reaper drone and a Russian fighter jet is a public manifestation of a secret that is barely concealed, and that is that the U.S. and NATO are engaged in a proxy war with Russia that could very quickly snowball into a full-blown hot war with nuclear consequences. And when you set this against the backdrop of the very serious question of who blew up the Nord Stream pipeline, you understand how high the stakes are right now for the world.
A U.S. surveillance drone crashes Tuesday into the Black Sea, about 75 miles off the coast of Crimea. The U.S. has accused Russian warplanes of intercepting and damaging the drone, but Russia says the United States provoked the incident. We'll speak to investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill about the drone crash, the war in Ukraine, the blowing up of the Nord Stream pipelines, and more. Then we look at the fight to protect reproductive rights here in the United States as a Trump-appointed judge in Texas is deciding whether to ban the abortion pill mifepristone across the United States.
We're talking about a judge in Texas who any day now could upend access to a pill that's part of the most popular method of abortion nationwide, impacting patients in states from California to New York. If nothing else, this case should put to rest any claims by the anti-abortion movement that this was ever about states' rights. It's always been about banning abortion nationwide through whatever means possible.
As news of Americans kidnapped and killed in Mexico makes headlines, we look at a story that's received far less attention, the tens of thousands of Mexicans who remain missing in Mexico. And we'll look at the latest on the Ayotzinapa 43. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russian fighter jets intercepted a U.S. drone over the Black Sea Tuesday, leading the operators of the MQ-9 Reaper drone to bring it down in international waters. The U.S. military says it downed the drone after its propeller was struck by a Russian jet. Russia denies making contact with the drone, which it said was gathering intelligence to help Ukraine attack Russia, and said it had entered a prohibited area near Crimea. If a collision is confirmed, it would be the first known contact between the U.S. and Russian military since the start of the Ukraine war. We'll have more on the implications of this, as well as the latest reports on the Nord Stream pipeline blow-up, after headlines with The Intercept's Jeremy Scahill. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren introduced a bill to repeal the Trump-era rollback of the Dodd-Frank Act following the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. The bill brings the threshold for banks that must undergo extra federal regulations back down to at least $50 billion in assets. The limit was raised to $250 billion in 2018 after lobbying by the banking industry, including SVB, which held around $209 billion in assets. This is Senator Warren speaking Tuesday.
The federal government, once again, was called on to take extraordinary measures, the kind of measures that Dodd-Frank was originally supposed to protect us against. These threats should never have been allowed to materialize, and now we must prevent them from occurring again.
California Congress member and Senator hopeful Katie Porter unveiled a similar bill in the House. This comes as reports emerged the Justice Department and Securities and Exchange Commission opened investigations into the collapse of SVB. The Environmental Protection Agency has proposed new rules to force water companies to remove what's known as forever chemicals, or PFAS, from drinking water. The man-made chemicals, which have been linked to cancer, infertility, thyroid problems, have also been detected in many common household products, including cosmetics and food packaging. Environmental groups welcome the move, but push for stronger regulations against the all-around use of PFAS and to force chemical companies to pay for their pollution. President Biden issued an executive order offering modest improvements on gun control, including increasing background checks. Biden announced the new measures Tuesday while visiting California's Monterey Park, where a gunman killed 11 people in January at a dance studio during Lunar New Year celebrations.
My executive order directs my attorney general to take every lawful action possible to move us as close as we can to universal background checks without new legislation. It's just common sense to check whether someone is a felon, a domestic abuser, before they buy a gun. The executive order also expands public awareness campaigns about the red flag orders.
Biden also called again on Congress to pass more robust gun control legislation, including an assault weapons ban. A Pakistan court has ordered police to halt its arrest operation against former Prime Minister Imran Khan until Thursday morning. It was the second attempt to arrest him this month. On Tuesday, hundreds of Khan supporters gathered outside his residence in Lahore, blocking security forces. Riot police fired water cannon and tear gas to disperse protesters in an hours-long standoff that ended earlier today after authorities finally withdrew from outside Khan's home. Imran Khan is accused of corruption and terrorism, charges he's denied and denounced as politically motivated. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is meeting with Ethiopian leaders today in Addis Ababa, including Tigrayan officials, 4 months after a peace deal was reached last November following 2 years of brutal war. Blinken will then travel to Niger Thursday in the first visit to the West African nation by a sitting U.S. Secretary of State. In southeastern Africa, the death toll from Cyclone Freddy more than doubled in one day, jumping to 220 Tuesday across Malawi, Mozambique and Madagascar, with hundreds more injured and scores missing. Cyclone Freddy is the longest-lasting tropical cyclone on record. Survivors in Malawi, which suffered the highest death toll, described harrowing scenes and heroic rescues.
The child was stuck up to her head in the mud. She's crying for help. Even though the water was very strong, we managed to cross and rescue her. It was very difficult, but we managed to pull her out.
Back in the United States, Novo Nordisk announced it's lowering the cost of insulin by up to 70%. This follows a similar move by drug competitor Eli Lilly earlier this month and comes after years of pressure from activists, lawmakers, and people with diabetes. It also puts pressure on Sanofi, the other major insulin manufacturer in the United States, to follow suit. Last week, Congressmember Cori Bush and Senator Bernie Sanders introduced the Insulin for All Act to cap insulin prices at $20 per vial. In Massachusetts, students at Wellesley College have approved a non-binding referendum calling for the school to accept admissions applications from non-binary and transgender students. Currently, the college only admits students who identify as women. The referendum also asks that the college's communications use gender-neutral language and pronouns. The proposals still have to be approved by the college's board of trustees. Ohio is suing Norfolk Southern over last month's train derailment, which spewed toxic chemicals over the town of East Palestine. The 58-count lawsuit refers to multiple violations of state and federal law. Ohio is seeking damages, civil penalties, and a, quote, declaratory judgment that Norfolk Southern is responsible. This is Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost.
Among the things we note in the complaint are Norfolk and Southern's escalating accident rate. It's up 80% over 10 years. And that's a concerning number. At least 20 Norfolk and Southern derailments since 2015 have included chemical spills.
Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, is laying off another 10,000 workers and imposing a hiring freeze on another 5,000 open positions. This comes less than 6 months after the social media giant cut 11,000 jobs last November. Another wave of layoffs and restructuring at Meta are also expected in April. In a victory for Uber and Lyft, a California court has upheld Proposition 22, allowing the companies to keep classifying ride, hail and delivery drivers as independent contractors rather than as employees, depriving them of basic wage and labor protections. David Huerta, president of SEIU California, said in a statement, quote, when gig companies can spend over $200 million to pass a law that violates our state's constitution instead of investing in workers, it's clear California needs better safeguards for our democracy, he said. The ruling's expected to be appealed at the California Supreme Court. Illinois has become the third U.S. state to enact a law requiring employers to provide up to 40 hours of paid time off a year for workers to use for any reason. Governor J.B. Pritzker signed the law Monday, joining Maine and Nevada. It goes into effect January 2024. And pioneering former Congress member and feminist Patricia Schroeder has died at the age of 82. She was elected as the first woman to represent Colorado in the U.S. House in 1973 and served for nearly a quarter decade. She championed women and workers' rights, access to health care, and environmental protection. She led the fight to pass the 1993 Family and Medical Leave Act, which guarantees workers up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave. As the first woman on the Armed Services Committee, Schroeder called for arms control and reduced military spending. She faced unrelenting misogyny throughout her career, but used her public platform to call it out and encourage other women to run for office. This is Pat Schroeder speaking on the House floor in 1992 in favor of the passage of the Freedom of Choice Act, which would have codified Roe v. Wade.
Especially as we are looking more and more towards national health care, we cannot have a national health care that does not recognize women equally. Otherwise, we'll be forcing all women into secondary class citizens. And I certainly hope that the Right to Choose bill gets a majority of this body, we pass it out of here, and we say to America's women, indeed, they are going to be treated equally.
That was former Colorado Congressmember Pat Schroeder. She died Monday at the age of 82. She served in Congress for more than a quarter of a century. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill joins us on U.S.-Russian relations after a U.S. surveillance drone crashed Tuesday in the Black Sea about 75 miles off the coast of Crimea after being intercepted by Russian planes. We'll talk about the drone, the Ukraine war, the Nord Stream explosion, and more. Stay with us. Major by Kyiv Chamber Choir. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show looking at increasing tensions between the United States and Russia. On Tuesday, a U.S. MQ-9 Reaper drone crashed into the Black Sea about 75 miles off the coast of Crimea. The Biden administration says two Russian fighter jets intercepted the drone, and then one of the jets clipped the drone's propeller, forcing the U.S. to down the damaged drone. Russia admitted its jets intercepted the drone, but said there was no direct contact and that the drone crashed on its own after making a sharp turn. Pentagon Press Secretary Brigadier General Pat Ryder spoke at a news conference Tuesday.
What we saw, again, were fighter aircraft dumping fuel in front of this UAV and then getting so close to the aircraft that it actually damaged the propeller on the MQ-9. We assess that it likely caused some damage to the Russian aircraft as well. To our knowledge, well, we know that the Russian aircraft did land. I'm not going to go into where they landed, But again, it's just demonstrative of very unprofessional, unsafe airmanship on the part of these pilots.
Russia's ambassador to the United States, Anatoly Antonov, accused the United States of attempting to provoke Russia by flying a drone with its transponder turned off near a military zone.
The aircraft was flying with its transponders turned off. It had entered the area where it had been determined that the special military operation would take place. We, Russia, warned everybody about this using international communications channels. I think it was a real provocation. They were provoking us to take certain actions after which they could accuse the Russian military of some sort of lack of professionalism.
Ambassador Antonov was called to the State Department. When he came out, he said, what would the United States do if there was a Russian drone outside of San Francisco off the coast? To talk about the drone incident and much more, we're joined by Jeremy Scahill, senior reporter and correspondent at The Intercept. His latest piece, headline, Conflicting Reports Thicken Nord Stream Bombing Plot. We're going to get to that in a minute. But first, Jeremy, if you can talk about the latest on the drone and the significance of it going down in the Black Sea. The U.S. says it hasn't been able to retrieve it in any way yet, though it is able to zero out all that it possibly has been surveilling inside automatically.
Well, you know, I think this is an indication of the real risks at play in this proxy war. I mean, the U.S. tries to deny that it's engaged in a proxy war, and yet we know for a fact that Moscow is correct in its assessment that it's not just fighting the armed forces of Ukraine and militias that are fighting on the side of Ukraine, but actually against the weapons infrastructure of NATO countries. And what I think is relevant about this particular incident is that the United States, and this doesn't get much attention, but the United States in particular has been providing Ukraine with actionable intelligence from satellite imagery, from drone imagery that Ukraine is using to strike at Russian forces. And so from Russia's perspective, this is a provocation on the part of the United States. It's not simply, as the Pentagon portrays it, you know, the U.S. was innocently flying, you know, its Reaper drone over the area to just sort of look at topography. I mean, this is a vehicle of war, and it doesn't have to have missiles on it to be part of a system that makes the U.S. a combatant in this war. So from Russia's perspective, you can understand why they would have scrambled and why they would consider this a kind of hostile act. Now, that's not defending, you know, Russia going and dumping fuel and trying to force the drone to the ground. But it's important sometimes to understand what motivates other actors on the other side of the barrel of the U.S. gun, or in this case, the cameras of a U.S. drone. But I think it dramatizes just how close we are coming to the potential for an overt conflict with the United States. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, soon after this took place, went on Fox News and suggested that the United States should be starting to shoot down Russian aircraft, and that the Biden administration should threaten Russia that if any incident like this happens again, that the U.S. is going to begin shooting down Russian planes. So it's an incendiary development, and I think it portends real dangers at play as the United States continues this proxy war.
And Jeremy, about this drone, it seems to me, first of all, that clearly we've heard that often that this war in Ukraine is one of the first where drones have played such an enormous role in terms of not just of surveillance, but of actually being involved in attacks. And of course, the reality is that if it's an American drone, the Russians would have to figure out, well, who's actually operating it? Is it Ukraine? Is it the Ukrainian military, or is it the U.S.? Could you talk about drone warfare in this particular conflict?
Yeah, and in fact, Juan, you know, Ukraine does have some upper tier level drones, but the United States to date has not, that we know of, has not transferred one of its top-tier drones, although there's an increasing number of U.S. senators and other lawmakers, and certainly the drone and defense war industry in the United States has been pressuring the White House to sell Ukraine Gray Eagle drones, which have a very long range, can carry a very heavy weapons payload, have the potential to strike deep within Russia. But the most powerful drones that Ukraine has right now are Turkish manufactured drones. And in fact, Russia itself really has not kept up or kept pace with the United States and China, for example, in terms of developing advanced technology drones. And that's part of why you've seen Russia using what are called swarm attacks, where they're purchasing much smaller kamikaze drones that are single-use drones that carry explosives. And essentially, it's like a higher-end remote-controlled missile. And what Russia has been using as a tactic is to send a bunch of these at the same time to strike at targets. Ukraine has also been doing this. And the United States has authorized a number of private contracts from American corporations to sell Ukraine single-use explosive suicide drones. And in fact, they've been escalating the supply chain to get more and more of these to Ukraine. But Juan, I think, you know, the question is a very good one. And we have to remember, the United States set this trend in motion that using weaponized, remotely piloted aircraft is now a standard part of warfare. And in fact, a couple of months ago, China unveiled a drone that is on par with many of the upper tier U.S. drones. And it's a matter of time before Russia does have some much more powerful drones that have not been used widely yet in Ukraine. That could well happen. But to me, what we're seeing here is Russia starting to confront what we know to be true and what Russia also has been alleging. And that is that the United States is not simply providing, you know, its ally, although non-NATO ally, Ukraine with a lot of weaponry, but is also actively providing Ukraine with intelligence that is allowing it to attack Russian forces. And that, I think that's what we're seeing, that Russia is starting to say, OK, we're fed up with this and we're going to start escalating from our end. It's very, very dangerous. And just one point I want to make, though, regardless of anything we talk about today, there's one person who could end this tomorrow, and that's Vladimir Putin. And so I think it is important to state that this is a war of aggression filled with war crimes. Vladimir Putin made the decision to invade Ukraine. None of that justifies U.S. politicking or the U.S. position. But Vladimir Putin should really squarely be held responsible for starting this bloodbath that's now extended beyond a year in Ukraine.
I wanted to ask you about the Nord Stream pipeline. You recently wrote a piece in The Intercept dissecting and analyzing the Cy Hirsch explosive report. Could you talk about that?
Well, you know, first of all, I think it should be said that, you know, Seymour Hersh is one of the greatest generations, one of the greatest journalists in American history, with a very, very long track record of breaking stories of great consequence on American war crimes, American covert operations. And I think that, you know, that often gets lost in the shuffle in people's confirmation bias inspired attacks on Cy Hirsch's stories. You could argue for sure that a single source story that appears to have a bunch of details in it that are contradicted by open source intelligence on ship movements and plane movements. They're all legitimate questions to raise. And I don't pretend to know the answer of what happened to the Nord Stream pipeline. And I also have my own questions about some of the citations in Cy's reporting. But here's what I will say with confidence. I know that if Seymour Hersh has a source that he believes has credible access to intelligence, and he reports it and reports those assertions, that there is a there, that it is worth pursuing, it is worth looking at. So what I tried to do in my story was give some context to what it's like to work with confidential sources. And one thing that we know is that very few people in government have access to every detail of a covert operation or every detail of a secret program. And sometimes what happens is that sources know what they know and they share that, but they mix it with speculation, or they mix it with things that were being discussed as a potential plan. I think it's plausible that Hirsch may have some of the details wrong, not because Cy Hirsch himself is sloppy, but because sources sometimes don't delineate what they know to be true from what is speculation. It's also possible that this was one of the plans that was being discussed within the Biden administration as part of a secret task force, and that they ended up operating the plan in a different manner. There's a number of questions that I think we should be asking, but what I think is the central, most important assertion is that Cy Hirsch has a source that he believes is legitimate and real and has information that is true, who is asserting that the United States carried out this operation or sponsored this operation. And I think that the dismissal of Cy Hirsch by so many people is reckless. It also shows a total disregard for the history of American covert operations. And it ultimately seeks to silence people who are questioning what I think is quite clearly the top suspect in this international act of terrorism. And that is the party that would have the greatest motivation to conduct this attack. And that would be the United States.
I wanted to go to what Russian President Vladimir Putin said, the bombing of the Nord Stream carried out at the, quote, state level. He didn't directly blame the United States, but pointed out the U.S. had an interest in the pipelines being blown up.
Who is interested? Theoretically, the United States is interested, of course, in order to stop the supply of Russian energy carriers to the European market and supply volumes of their own, including liquefied natural gas.
So that's Vladimir Putin, Jeremy. If you could, for people who aren't following this closely, summarize what the major news outlets are saying, whether we're talking about Die Zeit in Germany, pro-Ukrainian group, Russia, whether we're talking about the New York Times or Cy Hirsch, what each is contending.
Yeah. Well, so, of course, Seymour Hirsch says that this was a United States operation that was covert in nature, although it, according to Hirsch, once Joe Biden in February, on February 7th, 2022, Joe Biden has a meeting in the East Room of the White House, a press conference with the new German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz. And during that press conference, Biden is asked about the Nord Stream pipeline, and he says, you know, we will shut it down. We will get it done. We will end it. I promise you that. And what Hirsch is saying is that once Biden said that, that the operation that was intended to be a covert operation under Title 50 of the U.S. Code, which means that if the president issues a secret presidential finding that the U.S., for interests of its national security, has to conduct an operation and keep it secret, that under the law, the president of the United States is required to inform the Senate and House intelligence committees, or at a minimum, the so-called Gang of Eight, which would be the chairs of the Senate and House intelligence committees, and then the leadership of in both the Senate and the House. And what Hirsch is saying is that once Biden let the cat out of the bag by sort of saying, you know, we're gonna do this. Biden, of course, didn't say we're gonna go blow up the pipeline, but he, you know, you could read into it very easily that Biden was saying one way or the other, we're taking this thing out. That then the CIA and others said, well, this can't be a covert operation in that manner. So they shifted it to a military operation that would fall under a Title 10 of the U.S. Code. And in that case, you do not have the same congressional reporting requirements to the intelligence committees. So according to Hirsch, they were able to circumvent informing Congress because of this distinction. Now, I talked to lawyers, including the top lawyer for the director of national intelligence under Barack Obama, Robert Litt, who was saying that even with those semantics, that this kind of an operation would fall clearly under covert action statutes, and was questioning the veracity of that claim that no one from Congress would have been informed. But all of that aside, and I think it's just important to understand the distinctions for how covert actions are authorized. And by the way, Joe Biden, as a young senator, played a role in establishing these rules that now govern covert operations and in setting up the Intelligence Committee. He was a founding member of the Senate Intelligence Committee in the 1970s. So what Hirsch is alleging is that this was a secret operation with the support of the Norwegian government, and that it was done under cover of a NATO, a well-publicized NATO training operation, and involved deep-sea divers who were part of the vanilla U.S. Navy, not Special Operations Command,